Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahulastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man you may have seen in the Daily Express. It's Richard Herring. Oh, thank you very much. Oh, love to see you all. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Hoss from Bonanza the other day. Thought I'd put something for the old guy. Remember that? Remember the Bonanza, Dave? That's fun. Thought I'd do something for the older people. Remember Hoss from Bonanza? He calls it Rallist, but I would do if he hadn't died in 1972. So it's... Curse of Bonanza. I was in the Daily Express. This was the week of recording. It was my face next to just a giant image of a man just holding his balls like that. So all my dreams come true. That's what I just always hoped. That's paper my grandma and granddad used to get. They would never have dreamt one day my smiling face and going... I mean, I thought there might be a story like that eventually, but it wasn't. It wasn't what happened. It wasn't what happened before. Okay, and just like our final Kickstarter dimension is... this is a backer, paid a lot of money for this. It's from Crispin, who says, we will now observe a minute's silence to get maximum impact for my money. I'm prepared to give it a go. I haven't set the timer. Let them out. Wait, we haven't started yet. I can't even work out how to do the timer. There's a clock there. No. Okay, fuck it. I can't work out how to set a time. Let's try. I'll do it for a bit. See how long it is before it gets awkward.
Now, come on, have some respect for Crispin, guys. Everyone's got to be quiet or it's not going to work. Yeah, it's not going to work. So if you do that on the radio, if you leave enough of a gap on the radio, then the emergency broadcasting kicks in. I'm not sure. So I don't want that to happen. I don't want you to end up getting off menu or something by mistake coming in. So thank you, Crispin. It didn't work. I was in a Starbucks in Hitchin this week. That's how I live. And I was disappointed in Starbucks in Hitchin. I went to the toilet. And the toilet, it's a unisex toilet. Anyone can go in there. It's all fine. But they have the crescent-shaped toilet seat in there. Do you know what I mean by that? It's where there's a little bit cut out near this end so that if someone with a penis wants to urinate without lifting the seat, they can. The idea is they can urinate through that little gap. You don't see them very often anymore because they don't work. It relies on accuracy, and but only those with a penis, you know, anyone who knows who has a penis will know that they overestimate their ability to shoot straight as it is. And having one of those, it encourages people to try. That's what I would say. And we shouldn't be encouraged. What they should be doing is encouraging men to either lift the seat or sit down when you urinate, if you're our age, right, David? Sit down when you urinate. Because it'll go everywhere. So I just want to say to Starbucks in Hitchin, sort yourself out. So I'm just using my powers to do that. Is that all I've got? That might be all I've got. Right, so let's crack. That literally it. I suppose it would have been a minute longer if I'd had a timer for my phone. All right, my guest this week. Look, we've had a lot of people, a lot of the stars from Robbie the Reindeer, Close Encounters of the Herd kind, on this show, a lot, but we have never had Robbie the Reindeer. And this week we've got him. He's best known for that. He was also, of course, the gentleman from East Chiswick in Mole Flanders. That's why we're here. Will you please welcome the amazing Ardlo Hanlon, ladies and gentlemen? That's Ardlo Hanlon. Robbie the Reindeer. He's literally Robbie the Reindeer.
Hello.
Sit down. Robbie the Reindeer. Robbie the Reindeer. How did you feel when you got the Robbie the Reindeer gig? Do you remember the call coming through?
I realised I had arrived. And what a cast. I don't know if you remember. I mean, I don't remember myself.
I just know I've picked it a lot of times, basically everyone who's anyone has been Robbie, yeah. And Robbie the Reindeer.
Yeah.
And that's the third one, Close Encounters of the Herd.
Yeah. No, I was in the first.
You're in all of them.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
There was a very successful franchise.
Yeah.
What about Mole Flanders?
Could you remind me of everything else that I've done in my career?
That's three films of Robin.
Mole Flanders was actually one of the most embarrassing things I've ever done in my life. Mole Flanders, you know the book, the Daniel Defoe novel, and there was a movie version made of that. It was ill-fated. I don't even know if it was ever released.
Okay.
But Robin Wright played the main character, and she was great. And Morgan Freeman, he played her assistant, okay, her trusty assistant, her kind of gatekeeper, you know, for any rowdy behaviour by the clients. Would be turfed out. So I played a client. So I was in it for all of like 10 seconds. So I basically throw a coin disdainfully on the bed at the end of the encounter.
Okay.
And it was the first time I was ever in a movie of any sort. Mm-hmm. And the director kept saying to me, "Find the light." And I didn't know the terminology at the time, to find the light, which means stand in the light. And I didn't know what he was saying. And So I kept saying, "Stand here? Where? What does he mean? Find the light." And eventually Morgan Freeman, who was in the scene, said, "Find the fucking light." So I was scolded by Morgan Freeman.
Wow.
Which I guess is a claim to fame of sorts.
It is. It's pretty good. Did you work along to get the accent right to be from East Chiswick? Or did you work on the...
I didn't have any lines. It was just a toss of a coin.
Why were you called the gentleman from East Chiswick? It's a very long...
Moll Flanders was a high-class courtesan, is that the word? Yeah. And her clientele were all gentlemen.
Okay. It's just so specific. Chiswick isn't even that big.
Yeah.
Just Chiswick would do, right? Oh. East Chiswick.
Yeah. I mean, I had bandy legs. I think that's what.
Well, it's lovely to see you, and to get you on. We've had you on the Edinburgh version of this, but you've never done the London version, and so it's fantastic to have you here. There's so much to talk to you about. I've been enjoying you on Taskmaster.
Yes.
How have you found the? I mean, we can't talk about it too much because only two episodes have been out. We don't want to give away any secrets. But I was the champion of my series, so... And I'm guessing from the first two episodes that you're not the champion of your series, so that's my call.
Richard, it's surely it's too early to say.
It is too early to say.
You know, have you ever seen Cool Runnings?
How did you find it? Did you enjoy the experience? It's a pretty amazing experience.
It's a truly amazing once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that I would have shied away from traditionally over the years. Like, you know, I just didn't think I'd be any good. Okay. And I was right. But I didn't think I'd enjoy it. You know, I'm kind of shy about being myself and things, actually. But I was trapped in Dublin for well over a year during the various lockdowns, and I absolutely jumped at it. It was my first time getting away from Dublin in well over a year, and we filmed it last summer in London. We did all the tasks, and it's the kind of thing like I would pay to do, frankly.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it just brings out the inner child, and you're just you know. And like, I'm a little bit uptight normally, and as a stand-up, you're very much in control, and as a writer, you're in control, and as an actor, you're in control to a large extent. But here, there is no safety net. Right. So for me, for someone like me, it's actually really liberating. And I don't know if that was just a kind of a consequence of being in lockdown for so long, but it was pure freedom. It was like, honestly, it was the most joyful working experience I think I've ever had.
Yeah, you know, it really is. It's a fantastic team that work on it, I think. So when you treat it incredibly well, I think they know what they're doing. All the behind the scenes people are just so fantastic, I think, in it as well. But obviously, Alex and Greg as well are terrific.
And it's just lovely to watch them in action as well. And the people I'm with are just amazing, you know, and they're great fun. And from the first moment we met... Of course, you don't really meet till you get into the studio. You know, I think we just clicked, and it's very hard to fake like a competitiveness with people that you're getting on really well with. Excuse me.
But did you? Because that's how it started for us, and then it got quite competitive.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm in the middle of it, it's going to be competitive.
Yeah.
Daisy May Cooper was very competitive and quite scary. And we haven't stayed being friends, I wouldn't say. Yeah. Everyone else who'd done tasks said, "Yeah, we're on a WhatsApp group. We hang out." And do... No, not me. Anyway, not.
Yeah,
maybe the rest get together. Yeah. And I was looking at your early career, and I spotted that you won the Hackney Empire New Act of the Year award in 1994. Do you remember? Yeah. Do you remember that? You co-won it with an act called Wara.
Wara, yeah.
Do you know what happened to Wara?
I don't know. He had some really nice material, though, but he didn't. I don't think he was still doing it, like, within a year or two.
I remember him going to Edinburgh, and then that's the...
Yeah.
He sort of was a bit of a splash in Edinburgh. Then,
I think Ricky Grover was in that competition,
really?
Who was brilliant.
Yeah.
One of my favourite comics, East End comic.
Yeah, he's fabulous.
Yeah.
It's an interesting competition. In the year that Daniel Kitson did it, it was won by a guy called Anton. He won, Daniel Kitson came second, and Paul Sinhar came third.
Wow.
Don't know what happened to Anton. He's like, I think you'd retire, wouldn't you, if you beat Daniel Kitson and then you had to the year.
Yeah, well, exactly. For some people, that is the pinnacle of their career. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you were pretty successful. I mean, you came to London in about 1994, didn't you? So it was the year you came, and it was pretty much success straight away? You won that competition?
Yeah, not really, no. I mean, yeah. No, I've done a few things in Ireland, like Moll Flanders and a few little things like that. I mean, the very last thing I did in Ireland before I left was actually crime reconstruction. So there was a show in Ireland on RT, the national channel, called Crime Line. And so I was asked to play a sort of a small-time drug dealer who gets shot in the back of the legs. And so I turned up and, like, you know, I was dressed completely inappropriately for the job. I had this kind of blouse on me, you know, I looked ridiculous. I remember distinctly a wine-coloured sort of colourless shirt billowing in the breeze. It's just ridiculous. And so the idea was that two lads jumped out of a van and shot me in the back of the legs, and you know, and I went and the director actually took me aside and he said, you know, that's a bit over the top. I was absolutely gutted. I thought he was coming over to tell me, you know, good job, like very realistic, you know, very naturalistic, good man, keep it up. But no, it was like, you know, how could that be over the top?
How does he know what it's like if you're in the shot in the back of the legs? That's probably what you go, rah. I'd definitely go, rah.
Yeah.
That happened to me. Definitely.
But I just knew I had to get out of there. Like, that was really the only work available in Dublin at the time. So to come over to London, 1994, do stand-up. And stand-up was really hopping at that time.
Yeah.
Really, really taken off in a big way. And the kind of people who were on the circuit was Lee Evans and Eddie Izzard, Jack D. And you know, you'd be on the same bill as these guys. And it was really exciting. And then you were kind of funneled towards these competitions like the Hackney Empire competition. And there was another one, the Ha, Bloody Ha.
Yes.
Spitting Image, New Act of the Year as well, which I won. Beat that, Taskmaster.
Did you get a big version of someone's head as a result? No, you didn't.
No, I got a photocopied piece of paper.
But you were. So, what was your stand-up that you were doing? Was it because you obviously got picked up for Father Ted pretty quickly from that year? Were you doing? Was the persona on stage? Was it like Father Dougal, or was it?
Yeah. I was wondering how long it would take you to get to Father Dougal. But,
I'm going to talk about it briefly for the next half an hour.
No.
I want to get onto Death in Paradise, mate. I'm going to rush through this.
It was a bit Dougalish. My stand-up persona at the time was kind of like very, kind of bewildered, kind of saying, I hope, like kind of astute things about the world and human behaviour, but like... I suppose playing a kind of a very blank-faced, sort of wide-eyed, maybe kind of persona or something. Kind of hiding behind that persona, frankly, because like I was terrified of being on stage and, you know, kind of shy as well. So to have a kind of that kind of armory, you know, even you know, a persona. I mean, that helps.
I've read about you that you hate show-offs, but you love showing off. That is sort of but part of the ethos behind you, because you are quite a shy person in real life. But so what? Yeah. What attracted you to doing stand up? Which I can understand because I'm the same. But what attracted you to do comedy in front of?
I don't know. It was kind of like maybe an overreaction to that. You know, being quite shy and sort of always wanting to say things or express yourself or comment on something, but just holding back all the time. And then you get to a certain age where it just all bursts out of you. You know, it kind of just comes out in a big splurge. Then and I think for me that was going to university and debating and. You know, just putting myself out there and if it didn't work, I wouldn't do it, but it was working. So I just kept doing it.
Yeah. And do you feel in a way, because I know, you know, I know you're a stand-up at heart and you've carried on doing stand-up and you're still doing stand-up. Was the Father Ted gig as amazing as it was it a bit of a sort of albatross around your neck in terms of when you were going back on stage? Were people expecting?
Well, only in a tiny way, I would say. I suppose I just wasn't really ready, like, to be catapulted into the kind of theatre touring environment. You know, I was comfortable in the clubs and I had my 20 minutes, you know, half an hour at a push. And suddenly, you know, after Father Ted goes out on Channel 4 and it's popular and, you know, people think, oh, you need to think about a tour. And so I think I just was rushed into that a little bit.
Yeah.
And then there's the expectation factor where people, I suppose, they only know you as this character in Father Ted. So perhaps some of them were coming along expecting to see some variation of that. Now, yeah. You know, I looked like him and I sounded a bit like him, but that's kind of where the comparison ended. You know, I think my material was kind of different. I mean, it's still coming from a similar area, like slightly surreal and, you know, I suppose... reasonably, you know, gentle enough in its own way, but yeah.
I mean, 90 minutes of Father Dougal on his own probably wouldn't work too much.
I mean, you know, Dougal needs the other characters, yeah. You know, around him as well. You know, there was often talk about doing a Ted touring show, which I think we all just didn't want anything to do with that, really.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what I was doing at the time was like your bog standard contemporary London comedy, you know. Yeah. So I just think it was just a bit different than what people might have been expecting. But course, to be honest with you, like, another way of answering your question is no, it didn't bother me at all.
I like to have two different answers. We'll just choose which one, the best one to put out.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, but it's often the way that someone discovered it very quickly. And it's not always the best thing for them in terms of like being a stand-up necessarily. If you exactly what you're saying, you know, if you go from doing 20 minutes to suddenly being a household name, it's kind of hard then to make that leap forward. If you'd had another 5 years to do the circuit and really nail down what you were doing, but you know that's not how it works. Is that? I think you know
you take your opportunities when they come along. Yeah, like yeah. I can't tell you that like you know. Doing my crime reconstruction in Ireland, doing one gig maybe every 2 months. I didn't leave Ireland till I was 28.
Right.
So I did a lot of arsing around, you know, so I was quite ready for whatever London was going to throw at me. The other big job I did in my last week in Ireland in 1994 was I got a job flogging cognac in suburban pubs.
Right.
So I had to dress up as a butler, possibly... from East Chiswick. they gave me this big spiel to learn off about the history of the product. It was Hennessy cognac, you know, which had an Irish connection back in the mists of time. And to go out there to pubs and like do this big spiel for people and give them a sample of cognac. And the really lucky ones got one of those lovely cognac glasses.
Oh, nice.
But of course, like within minutes, people were just going, just pour the fucking brandy. You know? And so that was the kind of thing you had to do to get by in Dublin, you know, as a comic. So
because there wasn't like a big comedy scene, right? There was very few clubs.
There was maybe two or three clubs.
Yeah. So there's other jobs, according to, I think, IMDb, so this might not be true. Did you work as a pig farmer?
Well, I was surrounded by pig farms growing up. Okay. And I did spend a lot of time... with the pigs.
Okay. it says you worked in a Norfolk pea canning factory.
Absolutely true.
Okay.
King's Lynn.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. She was there.
Yeah.
So that's just after I did my leaving certificate, which is like your A levels. I just packed, just came over to England for the summer, because. There was this kind of work to be had in Norfolk. So why Norfolk? I really don't know. But funny, Bob Geldof actually worked in the same canning factory about 15 years earlier.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of alumni of the pea canning factory. Yeah. Was there something in the peas?
Something there. Something
Any
there.
Funny stories about canning peas?
Oh, no.
Did the machine ever go wrong and peas went everywhere?
No. I lived in a tent for the summer.
Right.
That's true. And lived on samphire, which was a local delicacy.
Did you get free peas?
Samphire. No pea. No. I got the cans, but I didn't have an opener.
Is it like working in a chocolate factory that, you know, the first few days you're just digging and eating the peas?
Yeah.
And you think, oh, I've had enough peas. I'm sick of eating peas now. you worked as a check-in clerk for Aer Lingus.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Well, it was as you'd expect.
I don't know. I've never been a check-in clerk.
It wasn't a bad job. No. I mean, it was a very good job by the standards of the day. Like it was a reasonably well rewarded job. And I remember in those days, you didn't check in online, obviously, so you met everyone who was getting on the plane. So you could do good stuff. Like, for example, if you met a really nice, let's say, man who was very friendly, yeah. And I would take a note of his seat number, and if a very nice lady, perhaps, came along later on, I would make sure she was sitting beside him, and so on.
Yeah.
And likewise, if I met her, honestly, this is how you'd pass the day. Like, it was boring. Likewise, if you met an objectionable person, someone who was, like, you know, very important and very busy and very dismissive of the minion serving them,
yeah,
I would make sure that they were in the middle seat.
Yeah.
And, you know, beside a smelly person or something, you know, yeah. So, yeah.
Right by the toilet.
And you could also misdirect the baggage. And you absolutely could. And
so
it did happen, because you just had the tags for each destination.
Right.
So you could put any tag on it. And yeah.
But, you know, you may have unknowingly created relationships.
I hope
And, you know, and children that may owe their lives to you.
Yeah.
You're playing God on the Aer Lingus.
I know. Service to humanity.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Now, is this true? This is the last thing I'm going to ask you about Father Ted. Did you spend 6 months in a seminary researching your own... This is what it says. I think, again, IMDb, but it might be Wikipedia.
No,
you spend
that is
6 months.
True. That research? Is not true. I didn't spend an hour in a seminary. Nor would I. No, that is simply untrue.
There's a quote of you saying that...
Does it really look like I did that much research?
I know what I was going to say. If you did, what was the... there's a quote of you saying that 90% of the people who worked who were in the seminary were like Father Dougal. Is that just entirely... Is that you messing around?
Probably messing around, yeah.
Good. Good, that's all I want
to say. I was mistaken for a priest on a few occasions.
Yes.
There was one... it was before the series was well known, so it would have been maybe during the filming of the first series. And I was wandering around in my priest costume around the shops at lunchtime, and I was in a shoe shop admiring the shoes, and a man came over to me, the salesman came over to me, and he said, you know, take whatever you want, Father. It's on the house.
Did you take it?
Lovely pair of Doc Martens.
Um, All right, I want to talk. Well, actually, I was going to talk. This predates this. You were in a sketch group called Mr. Trellis.
Yes.
In 1990 at the Edinburgh Fringe.
That's right. Yeah.
How was that?
With Barry Murphy and Kevin Gildee.
Oh, cool! Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it was great. I mean, that's how I started in this sketch group in Dublin. Really funny stuff. Barry wrote most of it. Things like, we would play three synchronized swimmers doing impressions of famous movies. So it was basically the three of us with pegs on our nose. You know, I can't remember the films, like Gorillas in the Mist, and we'd sort of squint. And, you know, it was... you'd have to be there.
Mr. Trellis is kind of... If that had turned out to be a big success, it's kind of a name that would have haunted you, I think, Mr. Trellis. It's a kind of very sketch show name.
Yeah, it is really. I think the name... There is a character in one of the Flann O'Brien books in A Swim Two Birds called Dermot Trellis.
Okay.
I think that's probably where it came from, because that's probably the kind of thing we were reading at the time.
Okay.
But, it is a very sketch group name. But we never fulfilled our potential. I mean, honestly, no. we weren't bad at all. And before, like, there was a real vogue for sketch groups in Edinburgh, where the sketch groups start winning Perriers and things like that. Like, we were nearly there.
Yeah.
It was the League of Gentlemen who were the first.
Yeah. They were the late 90s. So yeah. I'd done student sketch shows in the late 80s, which was the worst possible time to do sketches.
Right.
And the worst format and the worst place to be doing it. And, you know, people hated student sketch groups. And then we did a show in 91, I think, called The Dumb Show, with Steve Coogan, Patrick Marber, Stuart Lee, Simon Munnery and me, which, again, nobody came. It was the year Steve won the Perrier for his other show.
Yeah.
But no one came to see it at all, really. So it wasn't the sketch show's time.
It wasn't time,
We just missed
ahead of the curve.
But also Edinburgh-related, you played Coconut Tam in Greyfriars Bobby.
Yes, a glittering career.
He's a real character, right? Coconut Tam. That's
Coconut Tam was a real character in Victorian Edinburgh.
Right. He
well known. He had a hunch. He was big bushy beard. There are photographs of him.
Okay.
So this was the Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby. You know, the Scottish folk tale.
I do know it.
And it was a really good film. It was actually a really, really good film. I mean, Coconut Tam was only in it a little bit, but a great cast again.
Christopher Lee was in it.
Yeah. I remember filming in a graveyard in Stirling, I think it was, -15, with the mist, like, genuinely swirling around, like it wasn't artificial mist, and Christopher Lee walking towards me. That was kind of exciting.
Because you were a comedy fan right before you were a comedian, and you've got to work, I mean, I know you like the young ones, and you got to work with Nigel Planer.
Nigel Planer and Ed Edmondson.
Have you? Yes,
turned up in Death in Paradise, different series. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
That was the best thing about Death in Paradise, was the guest cast. You never know who was going to turn
up. What was bad about... I mean, I was telling you backstage, I've watched every single episode of Death in Paradise.
God, you're so unfashionable.
All the different incarnations.
Yeah.
They regenerate like Doctor Who.
Yeah.
You all do it for about 2 years and then you all get fed up and leave.
Yeah.
What's the true story about it? Because you go, I wanted to go back and do stand-up. It sounds like the best possible acting job in the world, that you go to 6 months to the Caribbean to film. Why didn't you stay doing that job forever, Ardal?
I solved 20 murders.
Yeah.
That's more than enough for any person in their lifetime. It was just dangerous, frankly, out there.
Right.
I think all the various detectives would tell you that it's just very demanding. I mean, like, it sounds churlish to say that, but it's brilliant. It was brilliant, and it was life enhancing, and it was life changing in many ways. I mean, you know, to live that lifestyle for 4 summers was incredible, and memorable, and every day was, you know, like memorable in lots of ways, but it was just like demanding. Like, I can't describe to you just the, you know, you don't sleep for 6 months. It's you know, you've got frogs making noises. What does a frog make?
Chirrup?
No, that's a bird. you know, croaking. And you've got crickets chirruping, and you have wild dogs savaging wild chickens, and you have, you know, fan whirring.
Did they not put you in a hotel? Were you in a tent again? Were you in your bee tent?
Yeah, I'm a very outdoorsy type. But it was just that kind of like constant. You know, there was always something killing something else.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just and the heat was so excessive, and the humidity. Like you were always wet. You were always like.
Well, you have to wear a suit and stuff, don't you? As the English.
Yeah, you do. And like between takes, you would have to take off your clothes. Like I'm talking every 15 minutes, you would have to strip down. And you'd have to be dried by someone. Like, which was bad for me. It was worse for them. But yeah. I mean, I'm just like people find it hard. You know, like guest actors love it because they come out for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they lie on the ground, you know, for a few hours every day. And then, you know, they drink cocktails by the pool. So it's fantastic. It's like winning a competition for
them.
The
best thing you could do is be the person who gets murdered.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you do one scene.
You have one day of filming and you're there for 2 weeks. It's great. Okay.
But that's what I'm angling for. I would just, that's what, you know, I could be the next, once Ralph Little gets fed up, and he's not going to get fed up, is he? He loves it.
He loves it
out there.
Yeah. But there's an awful lot to love, and the lifestyle was great. And just to learn about the history of the place, and, the horrific history of the place in lots of ways, and to really immerse yourself in this culture for months at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a rare privilege, and I wouldn't knock that side of it. But you know, as an actor, you're in every scene as playing the lead detective. You're working 5-6 days a week, 12 hours a day. You know, it's very, very demanding.
Mm-hmm. And it's the same show every week.
It's the same.
It's the
same script. Exactly. It's exactly the same. It's someone falls off a balcony and.
And there's always four people who could possibly do it.
Yeah, I know. I didn't even have to read the script, so I knew we did it.
If I was going to do a murder out there, I'd just shoot someone.
Yeah.
I'd shoot them, and then that'd be it. No, don't try any funny. Same with Jonathan Creek, which we might talk about next. Don't try any funny business. Then someone's going to work out.
Yeah.
How did this murder take place in this locked room? Yeah. Don't do that.
But I mean, you know, you watch it, or so you say. You know, what is the pleasure for you? Like, why?
I don't know. I genuinely love it. It's very. I can understand why it's maybe got a slightly older audience, which I'm now. You know, certainly part of. It's very. It's beautiful. It looks gorgeous. You can have it on in the background. You don't have to concentrate.
Yes.
Because
you can go for a little nap and. Come back, and I'll still be at that fucking blackboard.
You know, the first person.
Especially saying it over and over again. Yeah.
It's not going to be the first person. I think it's very, and you get it's amazing. The casts are amazing, exactly because of that. Because it's, I remember, in fact, Rebecca Front did it, was one of yours, wasn't it? And she's such an amazing actor.
She's just brilliant.
I was meant to be going round to her house for dinner. She said, "I can't do it. You can't come. I'm going to work on Death in Paradise." And I was cross for two reasons, and I haven't been invited back either. That's the thing with her.
Yeah,
she's going to go round. But you know, it's a good show. A good show. You should go. Would you go back for a?
I don't know. I mean, you never say never. I don't know. I don't know.
I heard you were going to write a memoir about your time on this.
I think I jokingly said that on a radio show, but I actually think I probably signed something in my contract saying I'm not allowed to talk about it for about 10 years.
Okay.
So I probably shouldn't even be talking about it now.
Okay.
I know. Look, it was absolutely great, but like, you know, it's I really do want to write that, but not for another 10 years.
Well, let's talk about you. Well, seeing we're talking about writing, you have just your second novel is coming out.
Yes, I write a novel every 20 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you did a novel in 1998, and so yeah, 20 quarter of a century later, we've come up with it's called Brouhaha. Mm-hmm. It's really unexpected. When I didn't know what quite to expect, but it's this is going to sound rude now. I was going to go, it's unexpected because it's really brilliantly written. But
thank you.
It's sort of not. I mean, it's funny. There's
you thought that like there was going to be just loads of like.
It's, but it, you know, like I was saying to you backstage, that it's often I read someone's book, and if it's a novel, I've got that. I've got, if I know the person, I'm sort of reading it with them in mind. But within a chapter or two of this, I'd sort of forgotten that you, it was written by you. It's sort of, you know, it's not. It's who not a comedy you, exactly,
think,
is it?
Who did you think wrote it then? Samuel
I just, it
Beckett?
Felt like Raymond Chandler had written or yeah. someone like that. It, you know, it's a real proper, gritty, mystery, crime sort of, and it's about, you know, it's a observations of society. There's funny stuff in there, but it's not like an ostensibly a funny novel. Yeah.
I think it's kind of like blackly humorous. Yeah. I mean, it's set in the border region of Ireland, which would be characterized as a place where there's a very deadpan tone. There is that kind of black humor.
Yeah.
You know, because it's border territory. It's people are kind of, you know, quiet and you know, you are careful about what to say, and you know, so everything is kind of a nod and a wink and you know, it's so I was definitely trying to capture some of that atmosphere that I grew up with. I come from that part of the world as well.
Well, it feels, I mean, it's a very light touch to it, I think, in terms of that you, it's not smashing you over the head with that, but you're getting the culture of the society and through it all. It's really, it's a very impressive novel, I have to say.
It's really
fantastic. So I would recommend, haven't finished it yet. It's quite long, yeah. But I will finish it, and that is that's the exciting bit. What made you want to? Well, you done this. Was it a young person's novel, the first novel, or was it?
Yeah, the first one was called Talk of the Town. Yeah. It was a sort of a coming of age story. Again, similar kind of humor, you know, that kind of dark humor. The deadpan tone was probably there as well, but it was about a sort of a tortured young man who was trying to, you know, figure out what to do with his life. This is slightly different. I mean, it's sort of on the surface. It's sort of a crimey, I guess, a kind of a murder mystery, as you say. But I think it has layers. Like, I think it is an observation of small town piety. It's satirical in places. It's you know, like English towns. You know, people are keeping up appearances all the time. You know, people kind of, you know, are kind of humble. They're very civil to each other, but you know, there's this really dark undercurrent. Something that inspired me would have been something like Fargo. You know, when I watched Fargo, the Coen brothers movie, the first time, I thought that's really familiar to me. You know, it's like I could identify with that, the humor, the tone, the you know, the gruesome violence. You know, I remember as a kid, you go to these nightclubs and things, and you'd be just shocked by the violence. You know, just. And then the next day, you know, everyone was really meek and humble again and going about their business. So, you know, that there was always that undercurrent. In small towns everywhere, all over the world, we had the extra little dimension in the border region where you had this kind of paramilitary thing in the background.
Yeah.
So then you had that kind of culture of slight culture of fear and the omerta, you know. So that just gives it a little bit of a, I think, an extra dimension or whatever.
Yeah, I think,
you
know, it's something
else to be worried about.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, people in England and, you know, the mainland UK don't really know much about beyond, you know, the obvious stuff. So it is really interesting to get immersed in that world. Your dad was a politician, right? So you've kind of got personal experience of that. The fears and the bomb scares and that sort of stuff.
Well, I mean, I had a really happy childhood, and you know that part of the world was safe, and I mean it was relatively safe. But 10 miles away, it wasn't.
Right,
just across the border, the other side. And so, as a kid, like, you were just really aware. You know, I watched the news avidly as a kid, and I read the papers. I used to run home from school in primary school to read the newspapers, and from cover to cover, I was just a really old-fashioned kid. And and then you turn on the nightly news, and right throughout the '70s. And into the '80s, like it was literally carnage every night—a car bomb, or people shot in their beds—and this was right across the border. These were people who looked like me, and I could really identify with. And my father was from that part of the world, so he would have known some of these people personally. And so, you know, you were always very touched by that. And I was always, like, from an early age, I was shocked that people could go on about their business while this was happening just down the road.
Yeah.
And so there was a touch of people putting their head in the sand about things like that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really impinge that much on the book. Like, no. You know, the
Yeah, was it something you're always doing with the writing, or is it because you've done so much acting and comedy and stand up, which is still writing?
Yeah.
So people don't realize necessarily. But was it something that you've been harboring a wish to do all this time, or is it you just had was it did you just have time to do this suddenly, or was it something that's been working on?
Like, as you say, I mean, the starting point for a stand-up show is the writing.
Yeah.
And you know, so I don't think it's unusual for stand-ups to try their hand at long-form writing, you know, whether that's a film script or a TV script, or in this case, a novel. My first novel, it was always something I wanted to do from an early age. Long before I discovered stand-up, you know, I would have been writing. So I would have been doodling from an early age, like from the age of 12 or 13, mm-hmm. writing little short stories, poems, as you do, which your goal was. and then, you know, I remember after the first series of Father Ted, where I took 6 months off, at least 6 months off to write my first novel, because it was something I always wanted to do. It's what I thought I was going to do with my life.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like so many people, you get seduced by stand-up, the immediacy of it all. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of, you know, stand-up is pretty cool in a way as well, you know, and you get to travel and, you know, and you get the instant gratification. So, you know, I put off the novel for as long as possible. Plus, like, you know, because we have this reverence for writers in Ireland as well, you know, you don't want to put yourself out there in that way either, you know, so you'd be reluctant to start. But eventually I did, and I was hugely satisfied with the first novel. But and then I tried to write a second one not long after that, and I failed miserably. I kind of stopped and started it too many times, and the tone went all over the place, and I never got to grips with it.
Right.
And that kind of set me back, a long way in terms of writing. And so about 6 or 7 years ago, I again took 6 months off. I hired an office, and I wrote an outline for this novel. And I always wanted to sort of write, it's not a strictly speaking a genre novel, but I always wanted to sort of play with the tropes of crime fiction, because I love crime fiction. I always have done since I was a kid. And I had at the end of that what I thought was a fairly decent first draft. And then I kind of left it because I got the job in the Caribbean, Death in Paradise. So I didn't get back to it for 4 or 5 years. And then... And then the pandemic happened, and I was kind of looking around for, you know, something to do, and you know, that was staring me in the face. And when I opened it up, I was really pleasantly surprised by how well developed it was at the time, and you know, I just kind of tore into it,
I mean, it's, you know, writing a stand-up show is one thing. There's a complexity to writing any book, I think, but a novel like this as well. And there's a lot of characters, and there's a lot of backstory.
Yeah, you have to keep a lot of detail in your head all the time. So yeah, it's a huge effort of concentration. Yeah.
It's extreme. You know, looking at Richard Osman, you like could take a quarter of Richard Osman. Would you be happy with a quarter?
Take a hundredth of. it's not really that type of. In fact, it was quite well. It's not really that funny, but. When I was showing it to a few publishers at the time, the feedback I was getting from one or two was, could it be more like Richard Osman?
Yeah. It's better than Richard Osman. I love Richard Osman's books. It's really good. I recommend it. Brouhaha, do read it. I'm going to ask you a new emergency question. Adrian Charles has a urinal in his bathroom at home. What is the most unexpected item in your house, or if you don't have anything, in any celebrity's house you've been in?
A piranha.
You got a piranha, or someone else does?
It's a dead piranha. I have.
You have a dead piranha?
Yeah. It smells.
Does it?
No. God. It depends what you think is unusual. I mean...
It does, but that's, you know, Adrian Charles doesn't think it's unusual to have a urinal in his own house.
I think that's a pretty...
Think it's a good idea?
I think it's a good idea.
I don't think it's a good idea. I'm very much for men sitting down to wee.
Well, it's not so much that. I just love a bit of porcelain.
Okay.
It's a nice object. It's a nice...
I'm not sure it is. You know, it's covered in piss, right? It's not that nice. It flushes, apparently. Oh. It can flush it.
As long as you don't have those horrible, like, discs, those kind of...
Yeah, little urinal cakes.
Yeah, is that what they're called?
The urinal cakes,
oh, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Should try one. Give
lurid
them
a... yellow.
Yeah, try one. They're nice. They taste pretty good. I'll ask you another emergency question. If all the art galleries and museums in the world said, we love My Hero, it's our favourite show, and we'd like to give you one, we'd like to give you one, or any of your work, that we'd like to give you one item from any museum or art gallery in the world and you can take it home and have it, what would you like to have?
Oh. What would I like to have from any art gallery in the
any
world?
Any art gallery or museum. It can be an artefact, it can be a painting, it can be a sculpture.
Oh. It could be a Picasso or anything. It
could be Picasso.
Could it?
Yeah, it could be anything. That's in the museum.
I would probably take something like the Edvard Munch work, The Scream, or something like that. I actually, the wallpaper on my phone is another Edvard Munch painting of people on a quay, in a little port.
He should have put the Scream bloke in it, shouldn't it? That's what, if I'd been Edvard Munch, I'd have put that Scream bloke in everything.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what... That was his gimmick. He should have stuck with that. Whatever he's drawing, that bloke should have been in the corner somewhere. That was the successful one.
Or a Van Gogh.
Yeah. And which Van Gogh would you like?
Any of them.
I'm not fussy. Good. Ardal, if you could go in like a caterpillar, go into a chrysalis, and you could come out as anything you wanted to be. Anything, right? It could be you with attributes, or it could be something else. It could be something that's not even an animal.
Like
What would you like to come out of? What would you like to change, and what would you come out as?
I would like to come out as water. What sort of a question is that?
It's a good question. What kind of an answer is that? Water. Why would you? What would you do if you were some water?
I would be drank by somebody.
Is that what you want?
Yes.
Okay, we've learned a lot about you.
Become part of them.
Wow.
And then they'd piss me out and I would end up somewhere else.
What if it's Adrian Charles and you end up in his, you're right? Could be a terrible, terrible thing. Like me, you've presented Top of the Pops and yet have not yet gone to prison.
Yeah.
How did you feel presenting Top of the Pops? Was that a big deal?
Oh, yeah, absolute highlight. Absolute highlight of my life. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It was just, I couldn't believe it, actually. It was just great. I remember what I was wearing. I had a terrible haircut, and I was wearing a blue velvet jacket. I thought, I'm on Top of the Pops. It's got to be blue velvet.
Was it just you presenting the whole episode?
Yeah, it was, yeah, yeah. I remember who was on.
Anyone good?
Blur were on.
Oh, that's pretty good.
But I was cheeky because at the time... Blur were kind of name-checking this great American indie band, Pavement, all the time. Yeah. So I introduced them as Pavement. Oh, I mean Blur. And that was a bit bold.
Yeah.
And who else was on? The Orb.
Oh, that's all right.
Remember The Orb?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Bush.
Yeah.
It was a good night. It was good.
Yeah. Very good. We had Scatman John and Robson and Jerome were on that. I think Pulp did one. It's Cher did one of the ones I did. E17. We were rude about E17 to the front of their stupid faces.
Yeah.
It's funny. So I sort of think I would like to have known I was going to be... When I was at school, if the people had known I was going to present Top of the Pops...
Did you track them down and write to them and tell them?
I would have been absolutely the last person. If you'd been at school with 1,000 people, you said, name in order who you think will present Top of the Pops out of the people in this school. Yeah. I would have been, you know, second last, I think.
But don't you think that that would be true of a lot of comedians, actors, musicians? There were kind of, I think part of the problem was we were disregarded as children.
Maybe. I don't know. It's, you know, it's sort of so far. I was so uncool and I'm still not that.
What's changed?
I'm still not that. Still not that interested in music. But it would just be so on. You know, Joanna Thompson knew that I was going to present.
Yeah.
She'd known. If you're listening, Joanna. Oh, no, sorry, I'm married. Yeah.
I remember there was... So there's a great show in Ireland called The Late Late Show. It's probably the longest running chat show in the world, or that's how it sells itself. And when we were kids, like, it's the equivalent of being knighted in this country, getting on the Late Late Show. And I just won that Hackney Empire New Act of the Year competition. And I was invited on to do 5 minutes of stand-up on the Late Late. So this was the biggest day of my life at that point in terms of career. And this was my chance to prove to Joanna Thompson's of this world, yeah, like, how wrong they were about me. And all the people at home who didn't believe in me or just couldn't believe that he's a comedian. For what? And the night I was on, kind of just my luck in a way, the main topic for discussion that night was murder. So what you had was, you had the relatives of people who had been butchered. There's no other way of putting it. Butchered in quite a spectacular fashion. And these were all high-profile stories in Ireland at the time. So I go on there and I start doing... I used to have this routine about how sheep get a lot heavy when they're wet. When they... but, you know, how... They'd gone on for an hour telling their stories, and the whole nation was crying. You know, the studio audience was crying. The host, a guy called Gay Byrne, legendary host, brushes a tear away from his eye and says, "Now, after all that, I think we all need a bit of a laugh." And he introduced me and I did my sheep stuff. Everyone's just looking at me. Going,
oh, my audience will be very excited to have you here because of you played... You were on Doctor Who playing a cat trapped on a motorway.
Mm-hmm.
Have I got that right?
You have, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. And a bloody good episode it was too. Russell Davis, it was one of his episodes that, yeah, that he wrote, and it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Really uplifting story. I was a cat creature, took hours, 5-6 hours to get into the cat costume.
Yeah.
And I remember they had to glue my face with two types of industrial glue to keep it on for okay, the day. And I was wearing contact lenses and they popped out because I was so stretched that they literally, like in a cartoon, just my... lenses and boing, boing. But it was fantastic. David Tennant era.
Okay. It's been referred to, I think, in other episodes. It doesn't look like you, does it? Because it's a cat.
It is a cat. It sounds like me, though.
Yeah.
And there is a model of my character.
Is there?
Brannigan the cat, yeah. 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 Okay. It's so cool. I mean, oh, yeah. And I was only in it like for about 5 minutes.
Okay. You're married to a human woman.
Yes, but we have cat children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good
decision. And there was one of the other things I remember about it. I remember it being a really great episode, but there is a very uplifting hymn at the end, the old Rugged Cross, which I think is a Welsh hymn.
Yeah.
And so all the characters in it, and there was a huge range of characters in it, all trapped in this traffic jam on a motorway, like maybe a 20-lane motorway. So everyone sings. So the end is this rendition of the old Rugged Cross. But we all went in to record it individually after the event. And I can't sing. And it was so embarrassing. I was singing the old Rugged Cross and the two studio engineers were under the desk laughing their holes off. That's my memory of Doctor Who.
And my hero was, again, costume-wise, was quite demanding, wasn't it? You're kind of put in these situations, like you had to wear a visor or something that was you couldn't see through. And you had to change in and out of the costume a lot, is what I read, that it was quite difficult to change in and out of the costume.
Well, there was a thong involved, which okay, had to be surgically removed at the end of the night. I had a costume made out of... They weren't my real muscles, okay?
Oh, really? That, not? Okay.
You just wanted me to come clean about that. Okay. That was a very enjoyable show to do. BBC primetime sitcom. Yeah. We did 5 series of that.
And then it went on and did more series. You changed over to James
They did
Travis.
One more after I left,
one more,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't as good. It wasn't as good as you are. Not like Ralph Little. Ralph Little's really made that part his own.
Yeah, I know. I can't agree more.
It was obviously like quite a little way away from Father Ted. Were you getting offered the similar sort of roles to Father Ted at that point?
Not I mean, not really. I mean, for a long time, I was like any. It's not that I was offered a huge amount of roles or anything, but I mean, any roles I were, you know, I was offered after Father Ted and My Hero, and kind of one thing leads to another, and you end up doing similar types of roles.
Yeah.
So I made a big effort at one stage to do theatre. I'd never done theatre growing up or in my 20s. And then, you know, I just really was curious about theatre. And in theatre, you know, you do get a little bit more scope, or people will take a chance on you more, you know, to do something a bit different. So I did 3 or 4 plays over a period of about 5 or 6 years. And, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. And I was able to sort of, you know, I think finally call myself an actor. You know, it wasn't until I did that... You know, I think you have to overcome certain things when you're known purely as a sitcom actor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to go to the next level, I think. Yeah. You know, and you know, I was always curious as to what else was out there. So I think doing plays for me was great, and I think since then people have been looking at me in slightly different ways. And you know,
but you've sort of done everything. It's what you know. That's what's you know. You've always worked, and you've tried different things and been successful in all the things. So it's, you know, it's an ideal career, really, isn't it? And you're constantly working,
well,
pretty much.
Yeah.
Are you going to do more stand-up?
Yeah, I still really enjoy it. The last stand-up I did was Friday night. Lovely little gig in a seaside town in Ireland, and in a disused church or a deconsecrated church. And it was absolutely beautiful. I mean, I really do love stand-up as much as ever now, I would say. I toured right up to March 2020 until the world shut down, and since then I've done a few Zoom gigs and a few little gigs here and there. But I really do love it. I mean, I think it does help not to be doing it all the time, and then only to do it when you really want to do it, and you know you kind of treasure those moments on stage.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you know the way you can you might have just been a stand up, you might have moved, you know, the way things just happen. And yeah. Move about, and it's kind of, you know, it would have been fantastic as well. But with you, it just seems so. There's so many opportunities, films, and you know, theatre, yeah. And TV.
It's kind of a combination of like drifting from one thing to another. You know, what materializes and kind of going in that direction, and occasionally then, just you know, giving yourself a jolt and trying something a bit different.
Yeah.
And you know, taking a chance, like you know, I'm very nervous about my novel coming out. Like it's kind of nerve wracking to have that out there because you don't know how people are going to judge it.
No.
But you know, you gotta take a chance. You know, you only get one shot at these things, and you know.
Did I read somewhere you say you kind of wanted to do? You want to do everything if you can with life. That like you sort of see life as being this. You know, you if you could try everything,
yeah,
you would.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Just do as you know, have as many different experiences as possible.
Yeah. Because we're getting older, aren't we? That's what we were talking about backstage.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of realise there's a limited amount of time left. There's a limited amount of, which when you're 30 or 20, you don't even really think about.
Yeah, it concentrates the mind, all right. Yeah, yeah.
And lockdown did that.
I think
well.
The pandemic did that absolutely for loads of people. Yeah, you know.
And so, what would you? Are you just going to try and keep doing everything? Do you want to move into writing, or do you want to carry on? I know you're filming something at the moment, so you're doing more acting.
Yeah. So, it's trying to keep the plate spinning.
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, I mean, I love the acting. I'd love to do more of that, more of the straight acting. You know, working with great people. I mean, part of the attraction is not quite knowing what's next. But I also love writing, love stand up as well. So you know, it's trying to. Keep it all going. I mean, sometimes it sounds when you're in an environment like this, where you're talking about your career, it sounds like you're doing an awful lot. But like, I have a lot of downtime. I mean...
Well, look, it's been really lovely to see you again and have you on. Do buy Ardell's book. You won't regret it. It's called Brouhaha. It's very exciting. I can't wait to find out what happens.
I'll tell you after.
Oh, tell me after.
Save really
you
the bother.
It's really genuinely brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on and do the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Ardell O'Hanlon. Thank you. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Ardell O'Hanlon. Thank you to Scant Regard, who play the music for these credits and do nothing else. I'm indebted to my producer Ben Walker. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, of course, for their fantastic help, and all of the Sky Potato crew as well. I am also indebted to our Kickstarter backers, who are, I'll put my glasses on, Phil Shoebridge, Mark R, that Chris Evans, yeah, that one, Moira Tulloch, Dr. Nathan Flood, Rich John, Simon Average Audience Member Masterton, Finton Demodi, Alistair Cross, Rob Baird, James Barter, Dave McCarroll, Liam, my apprentice stalker, Andrew Dolphin, Lucy Rainsford, Freddie Rayfield, Michael Sophie and Alice Sage, John J.T. Taylor, more like John I.T. Taylor, am I right, kids? Daniel Smith, Tamsin Porter, Knut Ola Nastredstrom, Ian the main man, Adrian Demeekin, or Adrian Domeekin, I always get it wrong, it's one of those two, in memory of the late, great Andy Burr, Kate McKeegan, Rainer Simpson, Stuart of Shrewsbury, latterly Hastings Burroughs, David Gilmartin, Hector Maroon, Steve Lowe, Ian Thompson, Christine Francescani, Spanglecock Bubblehead, Donald Fallon, Phil Moss, Harmonica Boss. And this is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFastTheStripe.com production. Head to richherring.com/gigs to find out when Rahulasta Party is coming to a venue near you. We are back at the Edinburgh Fringe, and we'll be back at the Leicester Square Theatre in September, October and November. richherring.com/gigs, richherring.com/Rahulasta Party/tour for all guest info and links. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFastTheStripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.